Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma. Is it welcome to us or is it welcome back to us? I hope you're listening to us and maybe you're even watching us. And I hope you've started to watch us now on our brand new YouTube channel, because many of the episodes have become visual in relation to what the guests are showing us in the studio or perhaps even through their Zoom filters as well. So please, I don't want you to miss out on that. The podcast is going from strength to strength, and I'm incredibly excited every time I talk to a new guest, and I've been looking forward to this one because every now and again I come up with a guest who has got an extraordinary story, and this is an extraordinary story. This is great evidence of how one person can be the change, how one person can create a movement, how one person can be an extraordinary force for good. And indeed, this story was turned into a documentary which won an Oscar and a number of other accolades as well. So I hope I have your attention. Come back to me just after this break where we talk to the wonderful Oliver Perkovich in relation to Skatistan. This story you need to hear. Come back to me just after this.
You're listening to The Leadership Enigma, powered by Transform Performance International, a podcast for the insatiably curious to explore the power of human-centered leadership to create real momentum for positive and sustainable change. Whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, or corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts, and disruptors as we discover that success leaves clues. Now, here's your host, Adam Pacifico.
Hi, so it's a huge and warm welcome to Oliver Perkovich. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing really well. Great to be here.
Very, very excited to speak to you again. A big shout out to our mutual friend, Mark Watt, for connecting us and suggesting that we have this conversation. And when we first chatted, my word, Oliver, do you have a story to tell? But before we allow the listeners and the viewers to actually start to understand that story, just give a little bit of a background about you. Who is Oliver?
I'm Australian. My mum's German. My dad was born in what's now Croatia. And I grew up in different places. I had primary school in Papua New Guinea. I started skateboarding at the age of five. So that's been something that's really, really important to me. And yeah, I guess I'm very open to new opportunities. I've always been very adventurous and looking for new things and new people to meet, new things to experience. That's me in a nutshell.
And I love that. Now, we are going to start to zone in on the skateboarding piece. As you say, you started skateboarding at the age of five, and that really is at the heart of this incredible story. This is going to be a real privilege to hear this story from you. But let me just ask you a question. What was it like to be so international at so early an age in relation to your parents' backgrounds and the fact that you were living around the world? What impact did that have?
I think it had a really big impact on me because I was lucky enough to have all of these different perspectives of grandparents in Germany, yep. Grandparents in Australia, the really big international community in Papua New Guinea. My best friend was a Chinese New Zealander. My other friend was Danish. That was pretty lucky as a kid growing up to just have all of those different, just to be exposed to so many different cultures, to be exposed to so many different ways of doing things. And yeah, that was a big shock for me actually going back to Australia, age 10.
Right.
Everybody being just very Australian, and I found it a little bit hard to fit in, and I just try to be as Australian as possible at that stage, which I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing.
I'm trying to work out what that means. I'm trying to be as Australian as possible, you know, and that's not me trying to do an accent, by the way. But in other words, you've really been attracted to living and working in a melting pot. and an incredibly diverse environment. And we talked about that blend of cultures, which you've grown up with from a very early age. Let's start the story, because I want to take you back to 2007, where I think that was the year that you went to Afghanistan, because your girlfriend had got a job there. Is that right?
That's right. I was in Germany at the time, and my girlfriend, Shana, got a job in Kabul as a researcher.
Right.
And I followed her there and was also looking for a job. So that's what brought me to Afghanistan.
Well, you had a research background as well.
I did. And so I thought, well, if she can land a research job, I should be able to as well. And but not having a job and being in Afghanistan was also a big advantage, because any employers had a lot of restrictions. They try to keep their staff safe. And that meant that I had a lot more freedom than many other foreigners on the ground when I first arrived in Kabul. I was really at the edge of my comfort zone. It was something that was very new. It was very unknown, and I try to apply myself as best I could to that new environment. I was very interested in meeting up with, I applied for different jobs, but I also got out and about on the streets of Kabul, and that was pretty exciting.
I bet. Tell me, I mean, most people I think will not have been to Afghanistan. I've not been to Afghanistan. So tell us, what were you seeing and hearing? What was the atmosphere like on the streets of Kabul when you were there in 2007? What were you picking up on?
It was a period of time when there were, I mean, a quite a large international presence.
Yep.
in Kabul. There was a lot of, I mean, what I think what I was honing in on was there were all of these different actors, so to speak, but nobody really, really understood exactly what was going on. There was the Afghan government, there was the international government, there were the UN agencies, there were the Afghans themselves, and everybody had their own little sphere of information and influence. But the whole thing together was just a little bit unknown for everybody. So I think it was an environment that I felt comfortable in, because I could also move from group to group.
Okay.
And I have a little bit of information from the kids that I was skateboarding on the street with, the ambassador that I had met at a party, the people that I lived with in a guest house that worked for the World Bank or for UN agencies. I moved very, very fluidly between these different groups, and I saw that straight away I had a little bit of an advantage, because other people weren't in touch with so many of these different stakeholders. So
gotcha.
I guess it was a little bit of a not knowing. A lot of people felt like they didn't know what to do next, and there wasn't very much long-term planning, I would say, overall from what I could perceive when I first arrived.
Gotcha. And obviously there are a number of skateboard decks behind your very head now that we're looking at. And I know that you took your skateboard out to Afghanistan, because obviously that's something that you had been involved in for many, many years. So tell me, how did that start, that you just, I think, started skateboarding on the streets of Kabul, as you have done with your skateboard in other cities? And what was the reaction when people first saw you skateboarding on the streets of Kabul?
Yeah, I mean, I've been a skateboarder since I was five. I'd traveled to lots of different countries before going to Afghanistan, and I'd always brought my skateboard with me.
Yeah.
So that was a given. And I didn't really think that much more of it. I arrived just sort of at the tail end of winter. So the streets were very, very muddy and dirty, and it wasn't really possible to skateboard in February, March 2007. But as soon as spring and we had a little bit of better weather, I pulled my skateboard out. Firstly, just skateboarding in the compound where I lived, and then taking it out to me and a couple of other people found some spots to skate at a local high school in the Central Park in Kabul. And yeah, kids were just absolutely fascinated by the skateboard, and big groups of people would form, just sort of like, wow, what's going on here? And that was all just very, exciting and interesting that the kids wanted to interact with the skateboard. And what was really interesting to me was the fact that girls wanted to try it out, because girls didn't ride bicycles. They, you know, in these same spaces, there were boys playing basketball or flying kites or doing all of activities that would happen in a park.
Yeah.
And girls weren't doing these things because they were seen as activities just for boys. And with skateboarding being just a brand new activity, it was somewhat of a loophole. And I got really excited about it and started to then run more regular sessions, concentrating on girls. At a certain point, we found this really great place to skateboard, which was an empty fountain.
Right.
And the empty fountain was a circular shape and sort of like a dish, like a bowl.
Yeah.
That you would eat out of, but much, much bigger. And what was great about this fountain was that I had control over my skateboard, because when I was skateboarding in the park, quite often the kids would try to run off with the skateboard and I'd have to chase after them.
So I'm assuming they're seeing a skateboard for the first time ever, many of them.
Yeah, I think for a lot of the kids, they'd definitely never seen a skateboard before. I'd asked some people, and they'd seen on Afghan television there was an advertisement for an Indian soft drink, and they had skateboarders in it. So some people had
like seen it on TV
somewhere, but that was really the only.
But now you were the real thing.
Yeah, that was the only context they had. So, and then, I mean, jumping on a skateboard for the first time is something that was really exciting for these kids, and I was excited that they were excited, because that was the feeling that I also had when I first skateboarded, and that same excitement that they had in their eyes, I shared that. And so the girls wanting to skateboard was exciting to me, and I started to give the girls preferential treatment. I let the girls skateboard longer than the boys, especially in this where I was running sessions in the fountain. I
mean, did you have lots of skateboards at this time, Oliver, or were you just using what you had, what you and your friends had?
I think I had around three skateboards right at the start.
Yep.
And we managed to then, as other people knew about the skateboarding program and were arriving then into Kabul, they were also bringing other more skateboards for us to use. But it was between three and seven skateboards, I think.
Okay. I mean, essentially, you're running a social experiment at this point, aren't you? There's nothing more than just you've got whatever skateboards you can muster, and kids are just joining in, and you're allowing them to have a go in an empty fountain.
Exactly. And what was interesting was the girls had more time to skate. Of course, they got better than the boys because they had more. They had more opportunities. And then I ran competitions in different age groups, and of course, the girls beat the boys in all of the in all of the age groups because they had access to the to practicing more than the boys. So that was the experiment part of it.
Right.
And that was that you could see the girls were just so excited to be better than the boys when in a society where boys are given a lot more opportunities, and of course then they get better at doing those things because they've got access to those opportunities.
Okay.
The kids came from lots of different ethnic backgrounds, and the different ethnicities in Afghanistan, in Kabul, didn't necessarily get along. And they were also divided by suburbs. So a certain suburb would be predominantly Hazara, another one would be predominantly Pashtun. And within the skateboarding session, the kids were all mixing across all of these different across these different ethnicities, but also across different socioeconomic backgrounds. There were some kids that were definitely better off. There was one of the kids, Feroz. His dad was a pilot for Safi Airlines, which was the Afghan airline. And other kids were basically had been working on the street since they were age five and were earning an income for their family for as long as they could remember. So that was another really exciting element for me, and
huge inclusivity piece, isn't there, Oliver? Forgive me for interrupting. What we know, don't we, that sometimes sport is a massive leveler, in that all are welcome regardless of backgrounds, religious backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds. And so it sounds as if you started to see evidence of this inclusivity and also the power of pulling people together, the joy, the new experience that people were having. At what point did you realize that this was more than just you running a social experiment in a fountain with seven skateboards? At what point did you think, hang on, this is really powerful, there's something here? So at what point did you think, I've got to do more?
There was a real turning point in those sessions at the Makran Fountain,
yep,
where there was a girl session one day, and the girls that came from all different backgrounds, rich and poor, different ethnicities, after skateboarding, they all held hands and started to dance around in a circle in the fountain and sing a song together, and that's not what amazing normally happens after after a skateboarding session. That's a very, very, very out there, but it was a real eureka moment for me, because there was. That's kind of what my wish for Afghanistan was. That was the wish that these kids had for Afghanistan as well. They wanted to have a united country. They wanted to have opportunities between all of them. They wanted to connect, and it was actually happening. So what the kids really wanted to see on a bigger scale was happening on a really small scale. And I thought, well, geez, if we could just work out how to scale this up, wouldn't that be totally amazing? There's something really, really special here, because I don't see this happening in other places. There was a really good example from I can't remember exactly which Olympics it was. It must have been the 2008 Olympics.
Right.
There was an Afghan bronze medal in the Taekwondo.
Okay.
What was very significant about it was that the person that won the medal, Nick Parr, was Hazara. And Hazara are basically the lowest in the pecking order of ethnicities in Afghanistan. Yet it was celebrated by the whole country. They were all excited that an Afghan had won
a medal.
And so I saw this. I mean, so many people understand the power of sport to unite people and bring people together. That was really when he won that medal, people came out into the streets, but they came from all different backgrounds and celebrated that.
Amazing. And
that didn't happen. There were many protests and many different times that people would come out onto the streets in Kabul, but it would be usually within a certain ethnicity, and this was a change. So
you saw that unifying power, didn't you? I want to give everyone a little bit of context, because when we first spoke, I think you said to me that half the population of Afghanistan is under 15 years old. Is that correct?
That's right. And 70% is under the age of 25. So a very, very young, young demographic. And also the demographic that really is interested in having somewhat of a different identity to that of their parents or their older brothers and sisters.
Right.
And because the kids that were, you know, these girls that were dancing around the fountain were all part of this, the main part of the demographic, I thought, well, this is exactly who we need to, this is exactly the type of project that Afghanistan needs right now.
Yep.
These are voices that need to be amplified. How can these kids have more opportunities? What more is possible here?
So this is what I want people to understand, is in 2007, you've gone to Afghanistan with your girlfriend as a researcher saying, I'm going to look for a job because your girlfriend has got a job. You've taken your skateboard there because you've been skateboarding since the age of 5, and suddenly, in some ways, you've rolled across, no pun intended, you've rolled across this opportunity of being able to unite children from all walks of life with the power of skateboarding. And you've described this incredible scene in the fountain. Am I right in thinking that you actually started to really leverage this power and you started to link it to schooling? Is that right, where you got skateboarding and schooling in some ways to be connected?
And yeah, and I mean, this came also directly from the children themselves.
Right.
The wanting to skateboard. I didn't go to Afghanistan with the idea of starting a skateboarding project. I didn't go into the streets of Kabul with the idea of teaching kids to skate. I went out there to skateboard, and they just really wanted to. That they really wanted to use my board instead of watch me skateboarding.
Right.
And so then the next step was that the kids that were part of the skateboarding program, they came to me and said, hey, we don't go to school and we really want to go to school. Can you help us go to school? And I kind of shrugged my shoulders at that point and thought, I've got no idea how to get you back to school.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've never been, but let's see what we can do. I really wanted Afghans themselves, and especially this most important demographic, the kids under 15, to be leading what they actually wanted in the country. And if they were then asking for education, then this was exactly what we needed to follow up on and try to deliver on. And so I thought that was an opportunity to help. I didn't have very much money at the time. I was literally living on $15, $20 a week, like
right.
really nothing. But I could afford a dollar a session for young girls to teach the other girls, because that was quite important from a cultural perspective.
Okay.
And I did one of the girls, Fazilla, she was going to school, and then she was 12 years old, and her parents pulled her out of school to basically beg full time. And I saw her as having real potential as a skateboard instructor, and she was already a role model for the other girls. She came from this really poor background, but was a really good skateboarder. So I came into an agreement with her parents that if I'd pay her a dollar a session, she would, they would allow her to go back to school. So that was the first link to education that we had.
Yeah.
And so she came on and was doing these skateboarding instruction for the other girls and building out that skateboarding in the street program, but she was also then able to go to school, and we helped a couple of other kids to also get back to school in this way. But it also wasn't very scalable, you know, there was only a certain amount of skateboard instructors that we needed, and I didn't have very much money, but at least this link to education was made.
But you're changing people's lives, albeit one at a time, Oliver, but you're changing their lives.
It was simply a chance to listen to them to what they were asking for, and even with really, really limited resources myself, it was possible to make some changes in these kids' lives, and that was exciting. That was exactly where I wanted to be. And it also made me think bigger again, because the girls that were 12 years old, they started to really get into problems with their parents or their older brothers and sisters taking part in sessions in a public space. After the age of 12, boys and girls need to be separated in Afghanistan.
Right.
And for the girls to continue to skateboard, age 13, age 14, age 15, they needed to be in a private space with no males at all.
Right.
And so that pushed me to think, well, how would that actually be possible? And we just started to dream bigger and thought, well, what if we create an indoor facility so that the girls can just keep on skateboarding, because they were all so excited to do that. And there was a group of around 25 girls and about 50 boys that were skateboarding at this stage.
Wow. But
because of the limited skateboards, the limited space, and in the time that I was giving the girls, that's kind of what the scale of it was. And I managed to meet with the president of the Olympic Committee, who just came in brand new into that role, Zahir Akbar, and he came to the fountain and saw the sessions that I was running.
How did that come about, Oliver? How did it come about that he came to the fountain? Was that you'd arranged it, or by chance?
That was a little bit of a chance meeting between I was playing, my mum being German, I spoke German. There were some Afghans that had lived in Germany previously, and I was playing football with them. And one of them had gone to high school together with the incoming president of the Olympic Committee.
Right.
They knew that I was like trying to make a connection to the Olympic Committee.
Oh, that's how life works.
Who they knew. And then I managed to have a meeting with him at the Olympic Committee. And then I invited him to see what was happening at the fountain. And he was blown away.
I bet.
And he said, right, I've got land. Let's build a skateboarding complex, and that was then the point in time that I started to just go knocking on doors and see if I could get some support to build an indoor facility on the grounds of the Afghan Olympic Committee.
And you did.
It piece by piece, it came together. The Canadian government were the first people to jump on.
Right.
And that was really just, again, a chance meeting. I was sitting in a cafe in Kabul on a Skype call with somebody, and I was really desperate. It was like, if I don't get $5,000 right now, I can't keep on doing this program that has started and is going on. And a journalist was sitting in the same cafe, overheard my Skype conversation, and then came up to me after my call and said, hey, I can introduce you to the Canadian embassy. And so the Canadians came on board with $15,000. Then I managed to snag a meeting with the Norwegian ambassador. He doubled that amount. I managed through the Norwegian ambassador, had a connection to both the Danish government and the German government, governments in their embassies in Kabul, and we also brought them into the project and managed to then build the largest indoor sports and education facility for children in the country in 2009 on the grounds of the Olympic Committee with all of these different governments, with a building company that was gave us a really, really discounted rate for yep. building that facility that it normally would have cost around $700,000 to build something like that in Kabul at the time. And they offered it to Skatistan for $200,000. And the donors were all just absolute, had their minds blown. What I was able to do with very limited funding and a really good connection to the Afghan government yep. in terms of working together with the Afghan Olympic Committee. And we also had some other external global partners, Architecture for Humanity, Nike Game Changers got involved. So I was able to put a larger pot of money together, use it really, really effectively, and then open up this facility that then had space for
incredible
around 500 kids weekly. I only allowed as many boys to take part as we had girls enrolled in the program.
Right.
So from day one, again, we had with the skate school, we had 50% girls participation. The kids from the Fountain helped to build the ramps. We built them together with Andreas Schützenberger, who was basically the best ramp builder in the world.
Right.
came out to Afghanistan, and we just delivered something that just seems so incredible to so many people. And the opening of that facility in October 2009 was the best day of my life.
Wow. And we've got a picture, actually. I think if James can pull up a picture maybe of, I think we've got some young girls on a ramp there. Is this part and parcel of that indoor centre? Whether you can see it on the screens, it might well be. I don't know whether that's on the screen behind me or...
You
can't see that yet.
I can't see it. The facility was it's a caseban building that was it had four classroom spaces. It had a large multi-sport court, so you could play basketball. We also built a climbing wall, and then behind it, a large indoor skate park. And we then were running 1 hour of skateboarding with 1 hour in the classroom.
Incredible.
And this was again the connection between
skateboarding and education. This is an unbelievable story. It's phenomenal, which is why I really wanted to have this conversation with you, so people can hear and watch this and in some ways be in awe. An amazing example of having no resources but an enormous amount of resourcefulness. You know, you've gone from, as you say, maybe able to share a $1 with getting just one girl able to help you. And then this has exploded and you've managed to get resources and buy-in and people have seen your efforts. And again, what an amazing example of one person being a change. And Skatistan was born. And tell us, where is it now? You know, 2023, what is the organization now? What's it doing? What's its size? Tell us kind of modern day story.
Right now, we have projects. We've got 12 projects around the world.
Yep.
We've got the skate schools, three skate schools in Afghanistan that continue to operate. We've got a skate school in Johannesburg, South Africa, and also in Phnom Penh in Cambodia.
Right.
And then we've got partner projects in a number of other countries: Kenya, Bolivia, Albania, Sweden, Jordan, Iraq, Lebanon. There's quite a lot of projects, and we've also got then a knowledge sharing network called the Good Push Alliance. And since Skatistan started, it has inspired a lot of other social skateboard projects to pop up all around the world. They saw what we were doing. They were really excited what they saw, especially in terms of that inclusion piece, being able to include children living with disabilities, girls in the programming, really being these safe spaces and hubs for creating amazing little communities. And we're now connected with over 850 social skate projects in over 100 countries. And we share knowledge with them. We've got we run webinars, we've got an e-learning platform, and all of those resources are available free to all of these organizations. We don't see them as competitors at all. They're all part of our ecosystem. They're all part of our social skate world. And we want to see them succeed. And we've made so many mistakes over the last 15 years, and we don't want them to
learn. I think it's called fixing as you fly, isn't it? And I want people to understand this is an incredibly inspiring and humbling story where a social experiment on the streets of Kabul with literally nothing, maybe six or seven skateboards, has now turned into an incredible movement across the world now, Oliver. And it's also turned into a documentary. I think it was Learning to Skateboard in the War Zone, and in brackets, If You're a Girl. Have I got the title right?
You have.
Right. Tell us about that, because there's even more accolades associated to this story, but you tell that part.
It's that was a really exciting film project that we took on with A&E from the US.
Yep.
And it's a story that follows a group of girls in Kabul that go through our back to school program. And so in the back to school program, the girls go through three grades of regular school.
Yep.
In 1 year with us. And then we help them to enter into the regular school system. So the actual idea behind that program was initiated by Fazilla asking me right at the start, like, I really want to go back to school. How do I do it? Us opening the facility and running these skate and create sessions.
Yeah.
And then some of the kids saying, hey, I want to go to regular school as well. How do I do it? And the film shows beautifully these kids learning to skateboard, these girls learning in the classroom, coming from all different coming from all different backgrounds. And the film initially was released at Tribeca. It won there. It was entered into the BAFTA Awards and won a BAFTA, and ultimately also was nominated for an Academy Award and won an Oscar all in 2020. So that was quite the experience to be at the Oscars. And I went there with Tony Hawk and a number of people from A&E, and it was really, really so exciting to see something that just started from just kind of a little bit of a crazy idea of listening to the kids to really literally being on the world stage and winning. So it was in the category of short documentary. So it's 40 minutes long, and yeah, I encourage you to search it out and try to and watch the documentary. What?
James is hunting through video now. I can see on there. I mean, this is just an incredible story, as you say, from the streets of Kabul. You, no money, a skateboard, and now you're talking about winning multiple awards for the documentary, including an Oscar. But more importantly, you've created a movement all over the world that is serving so many children in relation to uniting them, giving them access to education. I think it's one of the most extraordinary stories that I've had on the podcast so far. And I'm grateful to Mark for putting us in touch. And I'm really grateful for you taking the time to tell this particular story. Oliver, let me ask you this. What have you learned from this incredible journey?
I've learned a lot of things. I think what was really, really important was always being on the threshold of what was of my comfort zone.
Right, pushing yourself.
I was never comfortable. Right. I was never comfortable. It was just one situation after another where I was just hanging in there. And I'm sure that Mark Watt will also remember the multiple times that we chatted together, and I was just only just holding it together. I mean, the whole ride, and that's a really important place to be able to be open, to be able to be in the moment, and to be able to learn. If you're not really, if you're in your comfort zone,
you're learning.
These things aren't going to happen. And it was step by step. I mean, the first one for me was literally even just doing media. Some I think there were BBC and The Guardian and a couple of other. There's all of those news networks. Yeah. CNN also were all in Kabul, and they heard about the Australian guy with the skateboarders in a fountain, and they came knocking, and I didn't know what to say to a journalist about what I was doing, but I learned really fast, and that was the first time where I was like, okay, this is an opportunity. I've got to grab it. I've got to take this. This doesn't feel comfortable. I don't want to speak to a camera and think about exactly the right things to say, but I've got to just do it right now. And then I wasn't comfortable with asking for money and trying to get, but I had to do it. And once I did it, I did that next step. I didn't feel comfortable trying to establish a nonprofit on the streets of Kabul, but I was like, well, I just need to reach out and get support. It's like, there is somebody somewhere that has set up a nonprofit here before. How do I find this person? How can I get in contact with them, and how can they help me actually do this next step? So I was always putting myself out there, but I was always uncomfortable. It was never easy, but it was an exciting place to be as soon as you saw things working. As soon as I saw momentum, kids coming to the sessions, as soon as then the Olympic Committee president gave me a piece of land, as soon as these multilateral organizations all of a sudden started to give us, I mean, quite large sums of money, I was like, well, I don't want to let these people down. People believe in the project. They believe in the kids. They want to back it. Like, how do I now deliver on this next level? You've got to, I mean, my background, my My degree's in chemistry. So.
It's called diversification there, Oliver, that's for sure. You know what? It always takes a lone maverick sometimes to be that catalyst for change and being comfortable in being uncomfortable. I mean, so many wonderful, I think, leadership lessons out of this story, which is why I wanted you to tell it. How do people get in touch, Oliver, and join in the conversation, help you in some ways? I know you're still looking for funding and opportunity. Who knows? But how do people get in touch and learn more?
Skatistan has a website, so skatistan.org.
Yep.
We've also been very, very active on social media right from the start. So Instagram and Twitter and Facebook are really important platforms. Okay. LinkedIn, we have updates all the time. So find the at Skatistan and join in and get
involved.
You can get all of the updates there. We run multiple fundraisers every year, and we're currently looking for some larger collaborations. So we're really interested to work with companies that could imagine backing us for 5 years. And we're really the next step is this global expansion,
right,
and utilizing those 850 plus social scale projects all over the world that want to grow, have all of the knowledge from us in terms of how to do it really well, and we want to try to get as many resources right there to the ground where it really makes a big difference. These are local projects run by locals with very grassroots projects, so a lot of the time that have huge impacts in their in their community. So yeah, people definitely social media is and the platforms that you regularly use are a great way to stay in touch with us and,
right,
and find out more.
Okay. Well, I hope this episode does its part in getting this story out, and I certainly am incredibly humbled and inspired by the story. Oliver, I just want to say a huge thank you for taking the time to come onto the Leadership Enigma.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Take great care.
Join us again next week for more tips and strategies on the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with your host on LinkedIn or visit the dedicated website, www.leadersenigma.com, powered by Transform Performance International, where you can access our exclusive learning, including books, videos, bonus content, assessments, and more. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.